I do my show on the Heritage Radio Network because I think it's important to talk about the impact of technology on our lives.
I do my show to reach home cooks and help them do better.
Because I love getting together with people in the industry.
I like hosting my show because, to me, it's the stories about people and their relationship to food that help make the food more interesting and more delicious.
Our hosts do their shows as a labor of love, but we still need your financial support in order to keep the lights on and keep the tape rolling. Please become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Firesider, a health tonic based on the traditional New England cure-all of raw apple cider vinegar and honey. For more information, visit firesider.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday at roughly 12?
Well, yeah, we're
gone. Like 12 to 12:45, 1 o'clock, Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Call in all of your questions today, by the way, mead-related questions. We have a special mead presentation and dump meal related presentation. Call in all of your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Joined as usual with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, how's your week been?
Good. Fine.
Yeah. So a little later on, your sister, you wanted to tell your sister, like,
my sister's calling in at 12:30, she says.
So Nastasia, for those of you that are regular listeners to the program, I bought her for her birthday a crock pot and a copy of Dump Meals. That's right. Dump Meals. And so Nastasia can't – she's like, you know what, Dave? I just can't be bothered.
No, my sister has a nice normal-sized kitchen. I only have
I bought you a miniature crock pot.
But my coffee machine, I only have one surface for anything. So anyway.
You can make coffee in a crock pot, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Oh, weird.
Anyway, and I wouldn't recommend it. So anyway, so go ahead.
Anyway, so she's been making dump meals for the past 4 days.
So she, like
breakfast and dinner. She'll talk about
Natalina, right?
We'll say Natty.
Natty Lopez is the Cooking Issues dump meal correspondent. So she's going to be calling now. Nastasia, you said that your sister doesn't necessarily have any sort of. She's not in the food business.
No, and she's 22.
Yeah, but my point.
She's been eating cafeteria food.
By the way, she got a boyfriend. You freak shows out there, got a boyfriend. But she's been eating cafeteria food. You say your age. It's like, you know.
What? No, like, I'm saying she's so young. Like, yeah. she's only been out of college for a month.
Anyways, point being, she has no knowledge.
Right.
But I'm not going to, like, hopefully she's not listening to this and, like,
I highly doubt she's
good,
listening.
Good. Even though she's going to call in?
She's at work.
Oh, what is she working?
Hearst.
Oh, so we're going to get her fired from her first job out of college by having her call in and talk about dump meals?
Goal.
Sweet, sweet. Joined in the booth with, remember, we're going with Dave Id as opposed to me. Dave, how you doing?
Good, how you doing?
Doing all right. You have a good week?
Very good week. Excited for some mead talk.
Oh, yeah, mead talk. So our special guest for today.
Who is that?
What? Oh, yeah.
It's right there.
Oh, the engineer. Yeah, oh, Dave's okay. Over there. Yeah.
We met.
Yeah. So our special guest today is Raphael from Enlightenment Wines. Now, Enlightenment Wines, say hello.
Hi.
Hey. So Enlightenment Wines, why don't you tell a little bit about it? It's actually, you have a tasting room here in Bushwick, but that's not where the actual production happens, right?
Well, it will. I've been making the meads upstate for the last almost 10 years. And now we just opened a production space out off the Jefferson L. So we have a tasting room, and we have a beautiful facility for making wine.
Right now, I did not know this because I'm stupid. The technical term for a mead maker is
mazer.
Mazer. So you are a mazer,
right? It's helpful that way. You don't have to tell people you make wine because when you say that, they think of grape wine, and that's not really what I do. So, and also it's. You know, when you're a mead maker, you're also an herbalist, you're also a forager. There's a lot to it that's not just in the production space. In the same way that a winemaker often grows the grapes, but, you know, they're not necessarily thought of as farmers. So a mead maker has a similar kind of broader activity.
You ever have this happen to you? You haven't, I mean, you make mead, so you are a Mazer. So therefore, by the way, Twitter handle is NYMazer, at NYMazer, right? Or your
right, which, by the way, I've used about once, and I think it was to contact you.
Oh, nice. Well, start using it, buddy, you know, especially now.
Yeah, you have to teach me how to use it. It seems very popular.
well, I don't know. I'm not necessarily the best at it. You got to find, like, who's a Twitter maniac, Nastasia? You're
nobody
not.
Nobody we know.
Yeah,
nobody
we're, like, social media dunces. Anyway, the point being that... this is what happened to me for the past month, mm-hmm. right? So you read all these articles from roughly, correct me if I'm wrong, roughly like three to four years ago. So you're looking at like between 2012 and 2014, everyone says, the mead's coming. Mm-hmm. You have an occasional bottle of mead, usually by one of the larger producers in some of the wine stores. And then when I finally get around to saying, okay – now, the mead that I had when I was, young in my 20s was garbage, bad. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. In my opinion, I mean, maybe it's the way they wanted it. Maybe they wanted it to taste like it had all sorts of other weird fermentations going on in it and oxidized and messed up and, like, just not right and, like, not fermented out. And I think people were going for too much alcohol. But anyway, my mead experiences have not been the best. And... like a couple of months ago, I was like, this is ridiculous. It's one of the oldest beverages known, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
People drank it and drink it since time immemorial, right?
And also by pretty much every human culture on Earth, right?
Yeah, anyone that had access to
honey. Yeah, they figured out some way to make mead.
So it's the short answer is it's got to be good. That's it has to, like, there's literally there's no way that it can't be good. Something with that kind of a history to it, it's just the ones that I've had recently are bad. And then, I ran into the problem over the past couple of months that now I think a lot of wine stores that maybe started carrying, because I went to some of the places that were on some of those articles from the mead explosion of a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. and a lot of them just aren't carrying anymore. So you want to talk about the current state of mead and, like, trying to get it carried in wine stores and price points and problems and...
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about. I think, part of the Enlightenment Wines project is that it's largely self-taught, meaning that, I wasn't, I didn't apprentice at a winery, or I didn't grow up as a craft brewer or anything like that, and then decide to make mead. And that's partially because I wanted to start from scratch, and really with very few tools, right? So I did it without electricity practically for 5 or 6 years, partially to get back to understanding how it was really made initially. And now, I started making this stuff in 2000, right? So I've been doing it for a while. Now that I look back and I see the growth of mead and who's making it and why it's not always been made properly, I think it's pretty obvious. Part of the problem is, first of all, you got to think of the people with the resources to make it, right? So they're typically brewers. Right, so when you make mead, there's the equipment involved. Right, if you come at it with a brewing mentality, there's a bad side to it, which is that it's sterile. You're heating things, you're filtering them, you're doing all this very brewing is basically pretty high tech compared to winemaking. That's bad. It's good because brewers are used to sort of mixing things together and making alcohol out of it, but that first part of the process. Especially brewers who are used to, from the last 10 years, of trying to make increasingly alcoholic beers, increasingly hopped beers, right?
That's the American way.
Right. So you end up with a very high alcohol wine, which is typically sweet, pretty undrinkable. On the other hand, the people with the real resources and the knowledge base to make good mead, which are natural winemakers, right, which are people who are used to barrels, this stuff isn't sterile, it's very low tech, takes a long time, all that kind of stuff. And are used to the fact that every year is going to be different, that there's vintages. They're not trying to produce a Campbell soup can, right? That in that world, in the mentality of the natural winemakers, a lot of the things that are fundamental to making mead, which is adding herbs, adding fruits, mixing things together, specifically adjusting the sugar at the beginning, right? You can decide how much honey you want to start with at the end of the day. You mix water and you can dilute it, right? Those things are anathema to natural winemakers. So for them, and I'm speaking very generally here, it's a big leap to get into winemaking. So what that's done is left a real hole for the mead industry to have someone sort of step in who's using natural winemaking practices, but applying it to honey wine and kind of fruit wines, And you could say the same thing about fruit wines also. I mean, if you go upstate, there's lots of wineries that'll sell you a you know, like a dandelion wine, which is like a sugar wine where they wave dandelions over it, I think, or something, and you can't taste anything, or like a really sweet, like, cranberry wine. And
there's nothing actually fermentable in dandelions anyway, really. It's just a flavor, a color thing, right? I mean, you have to add the sugar from something else anywho, right?
Right, exactly. So here's our dandelion.
Oh, I've always wanted to have a good dandelion wine. I told the story, I think, a couple weeks, I don't know, months ago. My grandpa made a dandelion wine. He was really proud of it, and I was really young and such a dick that I was like, dandelion wine is like... It's some sort of like weird hick Pennsylvania thing you're making me.
And you'd be right, actually, because dandelion wines is what's actually considered like a country wine, right? A farmer's wine. So the history of the dandelion wine is really amazing. And if you look into it, it's really, you're going to find this in herbalism books, right? So like most alcohol made for the, you know, first half of humanity, it wasn't really to get you drunk. It was to preserve plants. It was to preserve medicinal qualities of plants. So New England farmers, for example, when they come to New England, right, and they're trying to grow stuff and, you know, they're, for the most part, don't know what they're doing and they don't have any citrus and they all have scurvy. Everyone in New England has scurvy for like 100 years between, you know, January and June, pretty much, right?
Is that actually true?
Yeah, because if you do subsistence agriculture, and you don't have access to, and you're not making sauerkraut, right? Which many of them, like, if they weren't German, if they're English or something, they're not making sauerkraut. There's just so little vitamin C in the system that, you know, they're eating like grass and stuff in the spring. And so if you have a dandelion wine, which dandelions are incredibly packed with iron and vitamin C and all these kind of things, and it's preserved. The tradition of dandelion wine is that in the early spring, kind of right when you start seeing the dandelions, you take a shot of it after lunch or something. It's a tonic. It's not something you'd like sit around with a snifter. It's a tonic. It's really medicine. So, and it had all these cure-all qualities for it, but, you know, really if you look at it's probably just simply that there. It's like, you know, when you have low levels of scurvy, you start having like, you know, it's vitamin C deficiency. You have, like, you get sick, you get colds and stuff.
Scurvy, advanced scurvy, Stasi would like it because it's like, it destroys the connective tissues of your body. So your teeth fall out, your old wounds
you get yellow.
Open up.
Yeah. You know, it's like a tan, but the wrong color.
Sweet.
Yeah. So anyway,
it's good business.
You can try some of it.
I would love to. By the way, what now? Is this a mead base with dandelion in it or?
This, you know, I usually end with this, but. Because it's the most bitter, it's the most complicated.
Like Nastasia.
Mm-hmm. You can start with this. This is an aperitif. Now, to make this, you have to actually pick a shitload of flowers, right? You can't cheat. So, you know, and you have about a week to do it in, right? So the bloom for dandelions is tiny. Like, they kind of grow all year, but they're really only around for, like, a week in a big amount. That makes it efficient.
So is the acidity from it strictly because you let a little acetic stuff happen to it, or is it...
Yeah, I mean, you know, honey wine, you have... Like, people think that mead is going to be like a single honey mead, right?
I like it.
Oh, thank you. It's a great spritz. They use it at PDT for one or two of their drinks.
Oh, those weasels. They're always on top of everything. What's the bottle price on this? Weasels! They're weasels! Who do you distribute through?
Wholesale? I don't. You have to get it from us.
Oh, so they're doing it illegally.
No. We have a license.
Oh, you have a license to distribute?
Yeah, I'm a farm winery, so I can sell you a bottle right here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's strength.
Actually, one of the brilliant things about our tasting room is that because we're the first people in New York to take advantage of this, so we've got a farm winery license. So in exchange for the restriction of using New York State ingredients, we are allowed the privilege of opening a bar next door, a full liquor bar. You know, we can have whatever we want. We can serve whatever we want. But you can go there, you can have a drink, and if you want, you can buy our bottles right out, right to go. So you can, like, have a glass of mead, you can go out, you can have a glass of beer, for that matter, or any number of the cocktails that we make with this stuff. But the nice thing is you can buy the bottles right there and go home with them.
So now what's the liquid base? What's the sugar?
It's honey.
Okay.
Right.
So I can feel some of that floral hit.
You're going,
like,
to smell the honey more than you're going to taste it.
How did you get the acid? Is it just from letting it, like, a multi-floral thing happen?
Right. Well, typically in a dandelion wine, you'd actually use a lemon juice. In general, the honey wines, what I was going to say was that, like, it's actually very hard to make a mead just from the honey and the water. It doesn't have the tannins, it doesn't have the acids, right? It doesn't have the structure.
Also, it doesn't ferment very well, right? Doesn't it stick?
Well, if you start with a really heavy ABV and you're trying to make 20%, yeah, you're going to have a hard time. But I don't typically have that. But it's if you're using processed honey, which I don't, there's almost no nutrients in it. So, you know, I'm using unfiltered, like raw honey. It's got pollen in it. It's got bee parts in it.
But you don't like dump urea in like beer makers do, right?
No. But sometimes.
Isn't that what that stuff is? Yeast food?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of. I mean, that's a whole other. Like yeast nutrients is a whole other thing. But. You know, typically, you either need to bring a fruit into it to bring the acid and the tannins, or you're going to bring some kind of herbs in it to bring the tannins up. The traditional recipe for dandelion wine requires lemon juice, which I'm not allowed to use until we can start figuring out how to get the lemons out of the greenhouse.
You
right?
need an orangery, my friend.
Right, exactly. So there is, I discovered in the park, in the cemetery, there is a New England, like, orange that will go through the winter. It's this tiny little it's called a trifoliate orange.
Yeah
And
those grow here.
They do. They're used as rootstock for other things. Yeah. Sometimes they grow out and you can see them. They're like nasty full thorns. It's like full thorns in these little tiny golf ball sized oranges that have no juice. But there's acid in there. We're working with that. I can use sumac's
delicious but very highly colored.
Yeah,
kind of colored. Take away the dandelion. I mean, I love sumac. I use sumac all the time. Yeah. And it's easy as hell to forage right. in New York.
Yeah, so this has sumac in it. We can try that one next.
I love sumac. There's something about sumac that's just so pleasing.
Have you had to pick it and take all the hairs off?
Yes. I don't take the hair. I'm typically making like sodas and cocktails, so I don't ever. It doesn't sit a long time, so I just do basically a quick boil, steep, strain, spin off, and
but
get
don't
it totally
you,
clear.
How do you avoid? I've had a lot of trouble with sumac, enough that like we had a fight this summer, and we're not hanging out this year because it was just I was like killing myself because I couldn't get the. Okay, so I would like multiple rewash the same thing over and over again. And then, but if I cooked it, I would get this sort of green vegetal flavor, which I didn't like.
Yeah, you have to rip out the centers.
Yeah. It's like unbelievably time-consuming.
First of all,
yeah,
people,
right?
have you ever never picked, first of all, the reason sumac's not popular, it's incredibly delicious, is because people are dumb and you're not dumb, I'm not calling you dumb, but like people associate sumac with poison sumac.
Right.
And like staghorn sumac, which is the one that I have growing near me, and there's a couple other different kinds of varieties.
Well, and also it's super variable, right? So
flavor-wise, yeah.
So when I forage for it, I have to go bush to bush and taste them, and sometimes they don't taste like anything. I found some stuff out in Montauk that had so much acid on it, they were wet from the humidity and white. Like white, like cream on them.
But hairy.
No, it was like they were literally citric acid crystals on the outside. I mean, it was like kind of like a marijuana, like wet dream, but it wasn't
of sumac.
Of sumac, yeah.
So sumac, when you harvest it, there's some smoother ones, some hairier ones. But the thing is, it looks nice and friendly and pretty. But when you start picking apart, you get this weird greasy feeling on your hands. But I don't know what that's from. And then inside is all this like nasty business,
right? Which could have bugs, whatever, and then the little seedy things.
Not could have, does have.
Yeah, definitely. No, I mean it's great if you want to make a cocktail, you want to make a punch. For me, when you talk about foraging something, you're talking about, like, can I get 50 gallons of it or not? You know, and so part of...
But it's very strong. It's very strong acid. In other words, you can make a good amount with... Let's say you were to get, like, a laundry bag full of this stuff, which is a pain in the ass. I'm not going to say it's
did
not.
Did it. Yeah,
you
know laundry bag. Like, did the laundry bag.
But that's quite a bit of sumac as an adjunct, not as
a... Yeah. So this is what I used it for this year. I'm going to go back to hibiscus for it. Because I like it's a little richer of an acid, and
I did a three flavor soda once that was all red. It was rose hip, New York rose hip, hibiscus, and sumac. But I just can't give up sumac because I just love it so much. Ooh, listen to that! That's Nastasia's favorite noise in the whole world.
This is called this is the Night Eyes. This is we blew when we opened about a week ago.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. We just blew through this stuff because we started selling it by the bottle and people just hang out with it and it's just
getting
gone.
All crunked out with
just
it?
Just gone.
So what's the ABV on this sucker?
Like 12.
So you're starting with, let me see if I can do my calculations, somewhere around 20 bricks or something like that?
I don't know. I have a funny story. So I don't use bricks. I use a hydrometer and... I probably should use a Brix, but it's kind of like when I was a kid. Like, my dad went out and bought us all, like, hockey sticks because we had a frozen pond. And I didn't know anything about hockey, so we just all got the only sticks. What he didn't know is he bought the whole family left-handed sticks. So I learned left-handed, and that's just how I play hockey now, if I play hockey. So I use a hydrometer for this. If you don't know what a hydrometer is, you should. It's kind of this miracle tool. So, like, it measures the density of a liquid. And it looks like a thermometer. And it, as a liquid is more thin, it sort of sinks. And then as it becomes more thick because of the sugar, it goes up. It costs about $7. The next best tool you can use to measure, like, the alcohol or sugar content in your liquid costs, like, $5,000, right? There's, like, really literally nothing in between that is useful at all. So I'm a huge fan of these kind of these very simple tools that are very low-tech. You can make a hydrometer. And actually, I learned recently that in the old days, do you know this?
What? The old – I don't know about it.
Do you know what the old hydrometer was?
Not what?
An egg.
Well, I know I measure salt brines with eggs.
Yeah, so they would use an egg. And so
I've never heard of people using it for liquor, though.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, it's not good for alcohol, but it's good for one thing, which is measuring the sugar content of the initial thing. And they would talk about the circle that the egg made, like whether it was like a half dollar. I mean, it's English, right? So they use pence or whatever. But
suckers.
Yeah.
But see, I'm old school refractometer guy, 100%.
So I just discovered that thing. It's amazing. What's nice about it is it just takes like a drop. And you can walk around with juices.
One freaking drop.
Yeah, it's really
good. You know what I used to hate? Filling tubes up with stuff and floating.
No, you're right. You're totally right. So the refractometer is really cool.
The problem is when you're switching back and forth, people who buy refractometers, especially if they don't think about it, they don't think about what it's actually measuring. See, everyone is using a hydrometer. They know they're just measuring the density. And so when –
But what if there's like stuff in there? That's what I don't understand.
Well, that's
like,
the thing.
Right?
So like you know – what you know, right? If you, like any kind of – any brew or wine calculator, you can know your initial gravity and you assume that almost all of that initial extra gravity is due to sugars, right? And then when it ferments out, you do the calculation, you do bang. But refractometers don't work that way. You know what I mean? Now, there are people that have calculated final gravity. So, by the way, there's you know, your initial or, you know, original gravity, and then your – what do they call the finished one? The F – I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you take these two numbers, and the second gravity is really a bullcrap number, right? Mm-hmm. Because let's say it comes out at, you know, 1, which – 0, 0, 0, which is theoretically the density of water. What that really means is you have some alcohol and some sugar because
it's
the sugar's
heavier.
It's
supposed to go down to, like, 995.
Yeah. Because you want more – yeah, you want more alcohol than obviously. So, but my point being is that people have tables where they know what your initial amount of sugar is, and then by reading the final gravity of it, you can figure it out. The problem is refractometers aren't – measured that way. So a refractometer is literally looking and the responses for sugar versus alcohol, I don't know how linear they are over the range you're checking. So literally you have to have someone who just takes a Brix, which is a particular scale, right, measuring, you know, refraction, because all it's measuring is light bending. And then you have to have someone calibrate the final alcohol reading based on a particular OG, and you just have to pray it's linear in that range, and if it is, you can use it. You know what I mean?
And then there's also some weird relationship between the two that's not linear.
No, there's not. No, you just have to tabulate.
Which is why, like,
tables.
I just, you know, I kind of stick with my thing, and I kind of know. I mean, to be honest,
it's always good advice to stick with your thing.
It's and also your tongue is also your best weapon, right? I mean, that's the you can taste the sugar at unbelievably tiny amounts, and so at the end of the ferment, the hydrometer just like gets less and less useful, and then you start tasting it out.
You just want to make sure it's not stuck before you take it.
Right. So like this guy, right? So this is a sparkling wine. It's not carbonated. This is made like a pet nap. You know, there's still yeast in the bottom. It's you know, you basically ferment out dry, then you add a little bit of honey or sugar back in, and you continue the fermentation in the bottle. If I was really smart, or I was like some old French guy, I've been doing this for 500 years, like I would just bottle it when I knew it had the right amount of sugar in it. But because I don't have access to either that like historical tradition of like really knowing that very, you know, when you make the same wine every year, you can kind of just taste it. But for me, I have to go dry and then go back for the secondary.
All right, we're going to talk about this particular wine in a second. We got a caller on the air. Is it a mead related caller? What do we got? What kind of questions we got? Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Dave.
Hey.
Hello. Is this my sister?
Hello.
Hi. Oh, hi, Nat.
Yeah, I thought you got it.
No. Yeah, no, hey, you're on the air. So this is going to be a dump meal. We're taking a mead break.
Could you tell me what a dump, and your listeners, I guess, what your dump meal is? And I hope it's something not what I'm thinking it is.
Well, it all, as I like to say, all meals end up as dump meals. But the, so Nastassi, you want to describe the dump meal? You want Natty to describe the dump meal?
It's, well, Natty, describe what you've been making.
Okay, so I did, four different meals with a crock pot, and I basically just threw a bunch of stuff in that the recipe told me to.
It's basically go to the local Circle K, buy some stuff, and dump it into a crock pot, walk away from it, come
for
back and
hours.
Eat it. That's what
yeah.
dump.
This sounds like the winemaking class I want to teach, where we go to the dollar store and we come back and we make alcohol out of that stuff. You just dump. I want to dump it in a thing. Come back in 2 months.
Can I just say, stay away from dollar store bacon. Just stay away from dollar store bacon, especially in your wines. But yeah, dollar store mead making. I think I would pay for that. I mean, a dollar. No, I'm kidding. I'm just messing with you. So, Natty, what have you been working on? What dump meals have you tried?
So I did an oatmeal, which I left in overnight, and that turned out great in the morning. I did ginger teriyaki chicken.
Okay. Tell us. First of all, oatmeal in a crock pot. I mean, okay. That's going to work. I mean, that's just going to work. That's oatmeal in a crock pot. Now, talk to me about the chicken. What cut of chicken did they recommend?
They did chicken thighs and chicken legs.
Okay. So some props. It wasn't some jerk with boneless, skinless breasts. Yeah. All right, so it wasn't inherent chicken dust you were making. Then what?
And then I had to do like a full can of ginger ale and a full bottle of teriyaki sauce and some other things.
Wow, this person likes some sugar there, the full can of ginger ale. Let me ask you a question. Did you have to brown that chicken beforehand?
Sorry?
Did you brown the chicken beforehand?
No, I just put it in there. I just washed it off.
Washed it off?
That's our mother's favorite trick.
You washed off the chicken?
Before I put it in the crock pot.
What do you mean you washed it off? You wash your chicken?
Well, I just wanted to make sure it was clean. Anyways, then I also did spare ribs.
Wait, aren't you supposed to wash a chicken?
No, you don't wash a chicken.
But it's got that like slimy stuff on it.
Well, but then that means you purchased a crap chicken.
Oh.
Hold on a second. Like, sometimes you can wash off if there's like bits of blood and you want to get them up, but it's not a freaking fish. You know what I'm saying? With like, or you're ripping the bones out of it. And it's a freaking chicken. It's already been dredged through like the hell and gone. They've already beaten the crap out of that thing. They put it into fundamentally a giant like washing machine made of rubber to rip every dang feather off of it. It's been completely eviscerated and sprayed down. Anyway, okay, hold on a second. So wait, so you these thighs and stuff, they had the skin on.
Yes.
But you in no way treated the skin in any shape, form, kind. You literally threw this thing in with ginger ale and teriyaki sauce. So the dump meal lady's idea of browning the skin was to dump teriyaki sauce into it. Am I on track here?
Natty?
What?
All right.
Like this lady's idea of browning the skin, the lady who wrote dump meals, was to add teriyaki sauce. That was in lieu of browning the skin, right?
One sec. Hold on.
What? Referring to the recipe?
I don't know.
This sounds like it's a nightmare waiting to happen. I mean, I don't know. Is there any sort of...
Are you back?
Yes.
Is there any sort of sautéed onion or garlic? Anything?
What?
Is there any sort of sautéed onion or garlic in with this dump chicken?
Well, there were two different chicken instances, and one of them had onion in it.
One? What about this first one with the ginger ale?
No.
So let me get this straight. It's just ginger ale, teriyaki, washed chicken in a crock pot for like 8 hours and nothing else?
That's all. Oh, and rice at the bottom.
Rice at the bottom. And did you add the rice at the very get-go?
Yes.
So that wasn't overcooked at all then. How was it? Tell me how it was. Was it delicious? Did you enjoy it?
Yes, I did.
You did? What was the texture of the rice like?
It was really fluffy and nice. It was almost like a risotto.
Whoa. Nastassi, are you going to let your sister say that it was almost like a risotto?
Maybe
crock pot?
Maybe you need to try it, Dave. Maybe
listen.
It's floating in the teriyaki and the ginger ale, right?
What, the chicken?
No, the rice. The rice is floating.
No, the rice is going to sink to the bottom,
no,
right?
No, well, it's... Okay.
And it's in a crock pot. It's like everything that you, you know, okay.
What about the other chicken that you made, Natty?
The shredded chicken, that was just with bell pepper and...
Wait, uncooked bell pepper?
That one in the crock pot first.
You throw uncooked bell pepper into with the skin on into a crock pot. Okay, next.
And then I think it was just the chicken breast, boneless.
Breast? Boneless breast for 8 hours. Okay, what liquid did you pour into this?
Water.
Water. And what else?
Nothing else.
Wow, how was that?
It was good. Oh, and I guess like taco seasoning.
Taco seasoning. Let me ask you this. Like, when you picked up the chicken, if you allowed it to cool, when you hit it against a table, would it actually, like, friably shatter? Was it like a chicken leather, or did it, like, was the chicken in any sense still juicy at all in any way, shape, kind, format? Or did you shred it?
It was easily shreddable.
She sent me photos. It looked really good. It looked juicy.
And then you put it in a taco, or what?
Then you put it in a taco, right? A tortilla? Yeah.
Yeah, can't go wrong.
Well, why would you ever use breast meat for that? Basically, what you're saying, it's just
the
like...
The only thing that didn't work were the spare ribs that I had to do.
Oh, my God. Tell me how the spare ribs. Tell me about the spare ribs.
Well, she wanted me to put a whole can of beer in.
Wait. Say what? Normal can of what?
A whole can of beer.
Whole can of beer. What beer did you choose?
What?
What beer did you choose?
I did, like, an IPA, but it smelled bad, so I didn't want to do it. And then... I think it was like a whole bottle of barbecue sauce too, and it just looked really gross, so I didn't want to do it.
But you did it anyway, or you didn't taste it?
I mean, like, I didn't even cook it. It just smelled nauseating.
Wait, how old is your sister?
22.
See, this is the problem with Instagram. They want food to look good. It doesn't always look good. Soups sometimes don't look good.
It just smelled bad.
Well, you know, but the thing is that you didn't give the alcohol time to cook off, maybe. Beer-based braises, like, for instance, the famous, like, Guinness beef that that the Irish folk make, is good, but not at the get-go. You have to – yeah, that actually does have to cook quite a long time. But the lack of browning disturbs me, like, in these recipes. It's like – I don't know. Anyway, so listen, are you going to continue – for us? Are you going to continue to be our dump meal correspondent?
Yes.
All right.
Look at that enthusiasm.
People call in your questions eventually, write in your questions for Natty and her dump meals.
Yeah.
Anything else to add about these dump meals? It really says don't brown these freaking things before you throw them into the freaking crock pot, for real? What about the onions you threw into this other thing? Did it brown the freaking onions beforehand? She's gone.
Oh, she's gone.
She's gone. She couldn't take the abuse. She couldn't take the abuse. She's not used to it like you are, Nastasia.
I've answered this browning question 3 times.
I just can't believe it.
Done.
Who does that?
Chat room says no browning in dump meals.
No browning in dump meals.
That's cheating, right?
I think there's a joke in there somewhere.
All right, so let's talk about, name this wine that we just drank that you're almost sold out of anyway. Can I have a little more of that stuff?
Yeah. I mean, we've got 3 more to go through. So
Nastasia, I'm sure you can keep like this, right?
Really, and you can keep this.
Really? Yeah. And Nastasia hates almost everything, and I guarantee you I know why you like it, because it's got some of the same notes that orange wine has in it, right?
Let me tell you something else. You originally asked the question. I actually did a lecture about this called Why You Don't Drink Mead, right?
Okay.
And, you know, your initial question is like, mead is the fastest growing a segment of the alcohol market, right? So that's great for our investors and us. You know, we're like, here we go, let's do it, right? But when we look for allies, and it's very different than the craft beer movement, which I think, you know, kind of came up together because there's so much good craft beer that people want to make. And there's definitely good mead makers out there, and I can recommend some. But part of it is the branding. You know, I operated like a kind of a club for about 5 or 6 years. That was most of my mead went to people who signed up on an email list. So I got to meet them. I knew who they were. One of the nice things about this product is that it's got a really nice gender balance. Men and women tend to like it equally. Drinkers. It's got a broad age range. It's got a good gender balance, which isn't necessarily true for beer and hard liquor, right? And one of the problems is that the branding for a lot of mead is like based on this like really inaccurate mythical Viking axes, the super macho stuff, super hetero, super macho. And I think it really turns off a lot of women who would normally actually like the product. So I think that would be the third kind of leg of the stool of like how not to make mead.
What are your thoughts on the Upper East Side of Manhattan?
I've been there.
Have you ever, no offense, Upper East Side.
Oh, wait,
yeah,
we both went to school up there, actually.
Oh, no, right? I was on the Upper West
Side. That's right.
Yeah. But, like, the thing about the Upper, no offense, I'm going to say it's like a generalization, but a lot of people in the Upper East Side is like, honey, so sweet. Honey, so
fair enough.
Sweet.
Right, so.
Right? I don't want anything with honey, it's sweet.
You know, you
how many times at events have you heard people say stuff like that to you, Nastassi?
Sugar, but not honey.
Sugar and honey.
No, you're right. Look. Grape wine is made from sweet grapes. Rice wine is made from sweet rice. Honey wine is made from... All alcohol starts out sweet.
Bingo.
And so, our biggest challenge is just education. You know, we just have to... That's why we make dry wines. We tell people, listen, this isn't going to be sweet. It's one of the first things we talk about. It's why we named the tasting room Honeys, because we want to, like, bring... We didn't want to hide that. We want to be forward about that. It's like, this is a honey-based alcohol... But honey has a lot going for it that's not sugar. You know, it's got this great bouquet. It has all this different variability. So try this one. This is like what you know, for lack of a better word, the straight white meat, right? You know, like we're trying to talk about, you know, part of what's exciting about this is we get to create the vocabulary for this product class, right? You know, we're trying to position ourselves as making the best meat in the country. So that gives us a position to say, like, what is it? How do we talk about it? What does it look like? What kind of glasses do you put it in? All that stuff. It's really exciting. Big space. Big open space. What I have not been able to do is figure out how to talk about the mead that we make that's just the honey wine. Because I don't want to say it's straight, because that's got issues. And I definitely don't want to call it white, right? Because it's, you know, compared to what? But this is, and I don't want to say it's plain, because it's not.
Be like, look, this is the Chardonnay of meats.
This is the Chardonnay of meats.
That's all I got to say to people. Listen. Who is that, Nastassia? What are you going to drink? Chardy. Ops. Remember that? Like, this is like, that was the short thing.
Okay, so this isn't the bottle. We haven't bought... This is on draft right now at Honey's. So we haven't bottled it yet. I'm going to go upstate and bottle it, like, in about a week. But this is basically what we're serving on draft.
All right, before we taste this, we didn't talk. What's the one with the bubbles called?
Okay, so the bubble one is basically it's a sparkling honey wine with apple, cranberry, cherry. These are tart cherries from upstate.
A little bit though, right? Only a little, I hope. It's fermented.
Little.
Yeah, okay.
A little bit, and then sumac and rose hips.
Rose hips are the bomb.
Yeah, rose hips are great. So, and then sometimes I alternate the sumac with the hibiscus, which depending what's in season and whether or not I'm at. Having issues with sumac.
And what do you call that one?
That's called night eyes.
So it's almost got a little bit of that, like, not over, but it's got a little bit of that kind of orange winey flavor, even though it's not like
yeah, because
oxidized.
Look, these are wild yeast. I make this stuff in barrels. It's funky.
It's quite nice.
Yeah. So this dry. You're going to taste it more.
And what's the ABV on this sucker, roughly? What are we?
Oh, pretty much across the board, I shoot for about 12 and
good,
half.
I like that.
Yeah.
Why do people want to make these things that require turbos? And
it's a macho thing. I really think it's like let's increase the alcohol. I mean, I don't know.
The aroma is intensely honey on this, right?
Yeah. Well, that's you know, it's honey's delicate, right? So you start mixing fruits and stuff, you're going to lose a lot of that, a lot of the more subtle features. What I like about this is we ferment this in used used oak, which has like a little bit of a red wine like left over in the wood. So that comes out, gives it a little body and a little color.
Oh, I like that. What do you think?
That's good.
And you're calling this one straight white?
We call that knot. We call that knot. But it's not really
knot,
a class.
Like the zero?
N-O-U-G-H-T. Yeah, exactly. That's our, like, zero.
Have you seen this advertising campaign for – it's called, like, white – I think it's, like, the most offensive thing because, like, they're printing the F-bombs on the street on paper, but it's called white girl rose. It's, like, everything's offensive about that.
Oh,
what is
that? No, it's bad.
It's offensive marketing, is it not?
It's by that guy, that terrible man.
What terrible man?
The fat Jewish.
You mean my dad?
Wait, who is it? That's the guy's name?
Yeah.
He calls himself
that's what he's called, the fat Jew.
Yeah, the fat Jew, sorry.
And he has he makes a product called White Girl. I'm sure he's going to make $1 billion.
Yeah, no, I mean, look,
I like
thank you. Well, I'm gonna plug our spot again because we just opened. We need some folks to come down there and check this stuff out. It's at 93 Scott Avenue. You can go to enlightenmentwines.com. There's addresses on there. And we're open every day but Monday.
What stop is it?
off Jefferson L. You can walk. It's like, you got to cross Flushing. And it's nice. You know, it's a great after-hours
place. Don't go to that
place.
Hospital. No offense if you're a doctor in that hospital, but oh my God. You know that hospital on Flushing?
Yeah, yeah. We're not that close to that. Right. Oh, yeah. No, no. That's the other direction. No, no. We're right down here. You could walk from Roberta's.
I had an interesting ER visit there once.
I've heard crazy stories.
The doctor actually was good, but the ER itself was like...
Yeah. Well, yeah. Welcome to America.
Yeah.
So I want to make sure you try this because there's just a little bit left. This is a Floralia, and I want just to give you the sense of a progression. So that's basically like our natural honey wine.
What's your bottle price in this, by the way? Will be rough.
We do 25 on a pretty much across the board, unless it's sparkling or we're just trying to have like a commemorative bottle. So, you know, if it's expensive, I put it in a smaller bottle. That's the deal.
Yeah.
But I make sure they're all the same height. So, all right. So this one is called Floralia. Now, this is what you do. Now, this is actually, a lot of people think the thing you just had is a classic mead. Like, I want a real mead. I heard you wanted a real mead, right? That's all I know. I never listened to your show.
Yeah,
I came in.
No big deal. No,
I mean, I don't know. I would. I did know about it, right?
Fair. Plus, we're usually very technical.
Yeah, that's on the internet, right? So, but a guy came into the bar, and he's like, oh, yeah, I was just listening to Dave Arnold's show, and he's like, he just wants a real mead. And I was like, oh, well, you should tell him we're doing this down the street. I mean, it's really close. And I think that people would expect that a real mead, in quotes, would be this kind of like single variety honey, right? Because that's a sort of grape wine mentality, right? Like the whole thing about grape wine is a single grape from a specific location and time and who's like carried through to its sort of essence. That doesn't really line up with honey wine making exactly because I really feel like there is a big difference between, say, a wildflower honey and, like, a apple blossom honey, right? They're different. And when you ferment them out, they will be different.
What about nasty honeys like buckwheat?
Yeah, sure. It'll be subtle. But I didn't want to... But in the real world, in the history of mead making, let's say, and I don't really believe in any kind of real authenticity around any of this because it's the whole thing's very sort of abstract and vague. But what one thing is for sure, it's that the idea that someone would make a mead and it would just be honey is probably unlikely. It doesn't have enough tannin. Even the one that you just had is, it's made in oak, right? That's where you get
so
that
wood.
I'm cheating. You got to cheat. It's somewhere you got to cheat. What's more likely is they would have made something like this, which is a mead with herbs in it. So there's all kinds of horrible Latin names that I'm not going to even mention and I can't pronounce.
Like methic gloom.
Yeah, exactly. They're gone. Like I'm taking them out of the book.
That all sounds like Society for Creative Anachronism stuff.
Right, exactly. And again, it's another one of those things that hurts.
Do you do that? Do you have like a Harlequin outfit or codpiece somewhere?
No, it's gone. Like it's gone. It's gone. I mean,
like I burned that last week.
I mean, the real issue.
I like codpieces though.
Is like, you know, the people who. You know, there's a public perception around mead that it's white and it's European and it comes from Vikings and all this kind of stuff. But the truth is like the people who drink mead are Africans and Indians and Chinese people.
Currently, yeah.
Yeah, and have done for their, you know.
Have you gone to Ethiopia to actually drink their stuff?
I haven't. We're trying to grow gesho right now, which is the herb that is required for tesh, and I can't get it to start. So,
is there a decent Ethiopian one here in the U.S. or no?
Not that I've had. They serve... I know the guy, for example, there's an Ethiopian restaurant in Bushwick that's fantastic. They have a honey wine. I don't love it. It doesn't have gesho in it. So you have to, if you're going to have an Ethiopian honey wine, it needs to have this herb in it, or else you're just getting like a kind of another processed mead that says it's made in a traditional Ethiopian style, but it needs the herb.
Right.
And if the herb's in there, it's got to be on the label.
Aren't there a bunch of strange, like more southern African meads as well, or no?
There are a zillion kinds of meads out there, and there are a zillion other things that people do with it. They distill it. I mean, Jamaica has a whole distilled honey wine culture that's super interesting. China, I mean, it's a... in China, you know, also there's a lot of my influence right now is I'm reading a lot of kind of Asian herb books because there they use wine like to preserve the herbs in a way that we don't do in the European culture so much. So like chrysanthemum wine or chamomile chrysanthemum wine.
Right. Our herb wines are mainly, they've been taken out of the wine category, like vermouth. So going back into sipping
situations.
Well, you
know, this thing happened when they invented the FDA, which is that they made it basically illegal to have any medical claims on any kind of alcohol, right? So, ironically, the Los Angeles winery that survived through Prohibition did so by making medicinal products, and then people just drink them to get drunk. But like, I make an elderberry wine. Elderberry is like an incredible immune-supporting antiviral thing. And it will work if you drink the wine, but I'm not allowed to say that. I can't put it on the label. I can't even talk about it. But so, for example, this one, just to get back, this is, I think, something more like a mead that you would have had in the old days. So this is...
And it's called what?
Floralia. And it's just an herbal mead. You could pick different herbs. This is forged juniper, lavender, and marjoram.
Oh, it's lavender's coming out, huh? Hey, yeah. I had someone on Twitter who was like, marjoram. And they were like, it's useless. Marjoram's delicious.
Fresh marjoram.
Yeah.
Can't use it dry.
Why would you dry it?
I don't know. People dry oregano. So this is, you can drink this straight, but it's a great cocktail base. So, you know, this, like, the
instead of, so you would use this in place of like a Dolin Blanc or in place of like a Coqui Americano or something like this?
Well, this is where I should probably introduce my partner, Arlie Marks, who I think he's met you. He said he did a stage with you at some point. But he's running the cocktail program in the front of the house. So he takes some of these things and then we'll make these kind of wonderful cocktails. This, I forgot what he's doing, like a flip with this right now, which he had to teach me what that was.
But it drinks like, it's like a honey vermouth.
Yeah, exactly. It's a fair like place to place it. Vermouth tends to be a little bit more alcoholic. I'm starting to make things more specifically for cocktails because there's so much opportunity to like do all this weird stuff, right? And so typically we'll take something like this or the blackcurrant wine, which is I think the last one here, which you can try, and we'll serve them straight, like in a small pour or over ice or something. Or you can, like, this one makes a really beautiful Negroni. If you want to, like, do a named kind of classic. And that's what we've been making down there. And then we also have this really nice herb program for the roof that's, like, a lot of the exotic herbs that I'm experimenting with for the meads, because we really have to broaden our appeal, we use in the cocktails, too, so that since they're around. So, like, there's a lemon mint marjoram that I'm really... Lemon mint marigold that, like, they'll use for a...
What are your thoughts on herbs that are, like, now considered toxic in large quantities, but, like, people still use them in the day, like rue or what's tansies and all these other things?
Yeah, elderberry. It's... The toxic is such a, like, difficult, unspecific word. You know, like...
It's like our relationship, right, Stas?
You know what's toxic? Alcohol is toxic, you know, and you drink that all the time. I think a lot of these herbs, you'd have to use huge amounts of them before you got ill. In many cases, if you heat them, the toxins go away. It's a little tricky with the alcohol because I have to get federal permission basically for everything that I use. So there's a list of generally recognized as safe, right?
Yeah.
But that list itself was created in the 40s and is horrible. Like, it's like you can put pennyroyal. Pennyroyal is an abortive and really, like, very toxic, right? You know, used by herbalists very carefully.
Fantastic name.
Pennyroyal. Yeah. You can pour that in there. So, like, that's considered generally recognized as safe. Lettuce is not on the list.
Spice bush, you can't. Lindera benzoin, not grass. So I don't use it at the bar.
Right. So I'm pretty suspicious of that list in general. It's not an accurate list. It was made a long time ago. And, for example, something like elderberry, which is on the list in some cases, it's like, it really depends on how you use it, if you're using the stems, the berries, or whatever. There's a really great article in the Nordic Food Labs about elderberry where they really try and tease apart the chemistry of that.
Yeah, I know those guys. They're good. Yeah. They have a really good actual science person, Ariel, doing a lot of their stuff. Okay, while we're opening this last one, let me do some shout-outs.
Brian Kestenbaum.
One second. I'm gonna read this. I'm going to read.
You're going to read what?
I'm going to read here. Okay. All right. Where is it? This is from Allison for Brian, right? Unusual request. My husband Brian is a fan of Cooking Issues and listens all the time, turning 40 on July the 14th, and I'm... Bastille Day, huh? Why do you gotta share it with the French? Why do you gotta share your birthday with the French? It makes no sense. And it's not like... And his birthday shifts every year to coincide with the French stuff. No good. No, that's not saying it's no good. Whatever. I'm collecting video/sound recordings, photos from his favorite places and people around the world. Any chance they may be able to give him a shout out on the show or send some sound recording that I can add to the collection?
Just do it.
What should I say?
It's turning 40.
Happy 40th birthday, Brian! Glenn from Cooking Issues Crew. And Jackie Molecules would say hi if he was here, but he's off on tour in Europe thinking about your 40th birthday. What do you say, Nastasia?
Happy birthday.
There you go. Happy birthday, Brian.
Wait, how many people listen to the show?
Tons. I don't know.
A lot. Are they all over the place?
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Wow. All around
That's
the world.
That's so exciting.
Everywhere.
Hi, everyone.
Everywhere.
Hello, the world.
All right, so let's get back to this. The rest of the questions that I would have asked, I'll have to do
You can just
time.
Do them, like, really fast.
No, I wish. Never. I can't. Never. No. Anyway, but let's taste this last one.
This last one. Right. So this is the St. Crimson, which is just a... This is a kind of a classic blackcurrant meat, which has been made for a long time. That is a kind of classic. But now, I don't know how much
blackcurrant...
Does
black it drink like a... Let me tell you.
It just tastes...
So that is also drier than I thought it was going to be.
They're all dry. Yeah, there's no sugar. You know, I don't like using sulfites and filtering and all that stuff. So the only way to bottle something and not use them is to just get rid of all the sugar.
I could dope this with some gin and carbonate the hell out of it.
Yeah, it'd be very good. There's a lot that you can do with this. It's a great thing. Although Jim from PDT was telling me, because when I made this for him a few years ago, I was like, he's going to love this. This is going to be great for a cocktail. But I think you can get a blackcurrant flavor out of the distilled version at a cheaper price, if you just want that. But this looks nicer. Also, this has that, you know, everyone's into that changing color sweet pea thing these days, but this...
Really? Butterfly pea?
Yeah, and this in
the blue one?
People, yeah.
Hey, man, we've been on that freaking train. Woo-woo!
Right. So those
who's
those,
using that in cocktails?
I don't know. There's an article in the paper again.
Which article? Which paper?
I don't know. I don't read.
Do they still make papers?
The big one. Yeah.
Times?
Probably.
Well, anyway, what's fun about this and the elderberries?
You know what the butterfly pea is actually called? You know what? Butterfly is the euphemism for female parts.
Oh.
Yeah, the scientific name for that plant is a lady
vulva,
body part.
That's not a bad word.
Not a bad word.
I know.
But why call it butterfly?
I'm saying, why can't you say it?
Because I don't know exactly how it's spelled in Latin.
Oh.
Methyglium. Yeah, anyway, you can change the color of this, too. It's also super acid-base sensitive, so it'll go blue or red.
You know. The problem is I'm always going to keep it acid in a cocktail. Like, someone who serves you a basic cocktail should get beaten about the head. I'll tell you this. If you want to stabilize bluer colors in cocktails, do a pre-shake before you add the acid with egg white, which is basic. And I found that for some reason, even when you shift the cocktail acidic afterwards, you'll maintain more of the bluer side of anthocyanins than you would.
What about like a gelatin? Is that also basic enough?
No. No.
Because I want to get this in one of those frosty machines.
But you want it to be on the bluer side, not less on the red side?
You know, I just like them. I just like that it changes colors. You know, it's just cute, you know?
I mean, the classic thing to do that is, doesn't taste so bueno. So I used to do this with the butterfly tea. We were going to do an absinthe service where we were going to do like a pandan water.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were going to keep that one neutral, so be on the blue side, and then drop it into acidulated alcohol, and then it would go red as it hits the alcohol.
Yeah.
Right? In an absinthe drip. Turns out that, A, it didn't have any flavor, so at least the one I had. So I was like, I can't just do a visual gimmick. This is crap. It's not what I'm about. And two, bars are dark.
Right.
And so, like, this is more of a cafe, brunch-timey, outside thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I've done the color change. You know what's really stable with those colors is whipped cream. So, like, I've done really, really, with a lot of the flour, dark, dark blue whipped creams that are, like, those things I heavily stabilize them with. Actually, the flour itself will stabilize it because it's got, like, if you just blend the flour and don't get rid of all the solids, it's got enough kind of solidity there. But you could also do, like, an agar fluid gel or something to get it to get it to go. So I didn't get to any of my normal like tech-related questions, but I feel I had one. I had someone ask me some interesting questions about spoilage in sous vide bags. There's also a question on flavors melding together, which would have been good, but I'm going to try to get Harold McGee to write in, call in on that. He's still in Spain, being Harold McGee in Spain, because he's the master. He's been working on that for, you know.
Oh, well, I have a question for him.
All right, what's your question?
I don't know why, but every winemaker will guarantee tell you this, that when you take the wine out of the barrel and you put it in the bottle, it tastes like shit for like however long it feels like doing that, for like at least 2 or 3 weeks, even if it tasted good in the barrel, and then it'll come back.
Huh.
And it's like it's getting used to the new container.
Absorbing whatever oxygen got hit in the ullage?
I don't know. It makes no sense to me.
By the way, before I go, questions for people. So, so what's your average fermentation time?
It's temperature dependent.
But what's the short,
everything you're drinking here is about a year. If I want to be a jerk about it, I could probably push it to 6 months.
That's for is it like a primary secondary situation? Do you have to rack off the
leaves? I rack, yeah. I mean, it's just like making wine. You just sit it does its thing. You rack it if you feel like racking it.
So closer to wine than to beer.
It's almost 100%.
You know
just
what
like
ferments really freaking quickly, like beer speeds, orange juice.
Yeah, but I can make this ferment quickly. It doesn't necessarily taste good.
No. Orange juice, yeah. Like on a fat. I don't know why, but it's just like I don't do a hard pitch. Keeping it at like 55.
But are you
60.
Putting sugar in it?
I take it to. Well, I want the alcohol. I'm take so sugar.
No, but I mean, do you add additional sugar in the beginning?
Yeah. So like, the first batch. I'm on my second batch. The first batch, I did white sugar to get it to about 15.5 Brix because I wanted about 8% alcohol. Okay. And so like orange juice by itself would be.
Like 6?
Yeah, because it's like 11.8% sugar, and it just wasn't going to be stable enough for me. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted it closer to 8%. So I added enough to get it up to 15 Brix. And this next batch, I did, and it fermented out. It did its primary in like a week.
But what temperature?
In a wine cooler, 55.
Oh, cold.
Yeah.
Wow, that's intense. Yeah.
I mean, like, I started it at 70 on the counter until it started going.
You're doing carboy?
Yeah, and it was oxygen starved. I put an airlock on it from the get-go, like not even open. Like, and then I threw it in a wine cooler, and it still finished. It was monster fast.
Yeah.
I don't know why. And I was pitching at the normal pitch rates. You know what I mean?
Do you know what kind of yeast you were using?
I mean, you would
some
hate
champagne
it.
Yeast I don't always use natural yeast. Yeah.
Relatively neutral. The yeast I was using is relatively neutral.
Yeah, no, I mean, I
did honey this time to take it up to 15, though.
Instead. Yeah, that's this better. Next batch. It definitely tastes better. Yeah.
What?
1 minute.
Got a minute.
Okay. Oh, all right.
Actually, so I'm gonna invite everybody to come by. If you come by and I'm there, I'll give you guys a tour. And I'd love to see you down there sometime.
Really nice. All right. Well, Raphael from Enlightenment Wines, and give him the address again.
Our tasting room is called Honey's, and it's at 93 Scott Avenue. It's on the other side of Flushing from the L train.
Opens at 5, right?
Yeah, 5 tonight and until nighttime. We're open late.
All right. Well, now I can say that.
And we have pictures. Can I? Wait, oh, and I would like a few more Instagram followers, frankly. I think I have a very nice Instagram.
All right. NY Mazer?
No, Enlightenment Wines.
Enlightenment Wines. All right. Enlightenment Wines. I can now say that I've had mead that I enjoy. Anastasia?
Same.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Very good. Thanks for coming on. Cooking Issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.